Welcome to Mission Critical, a podcast about the big picture, the purpose, and the values that drive today's most game-changing companies, entrepreneurs, and leaders. I'm your host, Lance Chung, Editor-in-Chief of Glory Media, and I'll be introducing you to a group of brilliant minds who are making an impact on the world and forging the path ahead. While they may all be very different from each other, the question remains the same. What's your mission?
Good morning, Eric. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me and our team here at your beautiful new restaurant, Akin. It looks stunning, and it looks like you put a lot of hard work into it. How are you feeling?
Yeah, it's been, openings are never easy. There's been challenges along the way, but I feel pretty happy that we're finally serving guests.
Yeah, it's like a new child for you.
Yeah, and I do have a new child, so it's like I've been a pretty absent father.
Oh, double whammy though, right? Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm curious, so we're here on like kind of a nice morning outside in Toronto, which is typical, but what's like your typical morning look like? Are you like a breakfast person, or do you like to start off your day with like a big meal, or are you like an intermittent fast or something? What's your vibe?
So usually if the schedule was a bit more permitting, right now it's just like wake up, come to work. Mm-hmm. But normally I would like do a fasted workout and then have a protein bar and then carry on with my day. So it's usually like 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. workout and then get to work.
Yeah.
But right now it's like, well, as a business owner, the second you wake up, it's work. So, so I just don't have that time.
So power bar is the breakfast of champions.
Yes.
In Eric's household. So when I was doing my research, you and I, as I realized, have similar roots in the sciences. I was a biochemistry major, and you started off your career as a chemical engineer. Did organic chemistry just like traumatize you in the same way that it did for me?
Dude, it was so hard. Yeah, it was like so hard. And even like triple integrals math, like calculus was pretty hard for me too.
Yeah. Is that the reason why, like, for me, I remember organic, I actually remember loving science until I got into that program. And I was like, this is the most traumatic thing that's happened to me. Organic chemistry was the most insane course for me. And then I ended up transitioning out of that program. But you ended up going for, like, moving forward, you ended up pursuing a career in chemical engineering. What inspired you to really pursue that path originally?
Asian parents, I would say. Asian parents mostly, because, you know, it's either like doctor, engineer, lawyer. We're pretty much your only options. And I wasn't very good at biology or arguing at the time. It was engineering. And then at that time, Breaking Bad was like booming. So I was like, all right, chemical seems pretty cool.
Yeah. It was part of the cultural zeitgeist at that time too, right?
Yeah.
So how long did you end up staying in that field for?
6 months.
Six months.
So yeah, I went to school. It was like 4 years. Studied, graduated, got a job at Next Cycle Plastics, which like pelletized HDP and LDP in Brampton. And it was like so boring. Like, just no disrespect to the company. It was just like not for me. Like, you know, like dozing off at my desk, falling asleep driving home. It was like just not what I wanted the rest of my life to be.
Mm-hmm. Did you have, you know, a lot of family members that were in kind of similar fields and you know, were kind of pressured to kind of move in that direction? I mean, it is kind of like the Asian stereotype in that we are supposed to pursue careers in specific fields. But did you feel that you had that pressure to kind of pursue that?
I don't think it was a pressure to pursue the same, but both my parents have a bachelor's degree in science for chemistry, and my brother was a chemical engineer as well. But I don't think it's because they were in chemistry that I chose to do chemical engineering, or it was like subconsciously I did. I don't know.
Yeah.
But like, I don't think it was a conscious decision. It was more so, you know, in Asian culture, everybody wants to just brag about their kids. It's more about like showing face. So when I was like, oh, I really want to be a chef, like, chefs don't make money. You don't want to do that. I was like, oh, okay, I guess I can't do that.
So in between, you know, your days working or pursuing that career, where did you find that you really discovered your joy and passion for the world of food, and kind of what were those first steps that you took into that
field? I think right away, growing up, even when I was in middle school, I already showed like a lot of interest in the kitchen. There's photos of me following my grandfather around, who was a self-taught chef as well, since I was six. Like, a lot of my fond memories is just cooking with my grandfather in the kitchen. And he's the kin in Akin. So he's a lot of the reason why I decided to pursue cooking. And then in high school, literally all I want to do when I got home from school is like put on Food Network, watch cooking shows while I'm doing my homework, but it would be always on the side. So like just absorbing as much information as possible when it came to food. And even in university, everyone was studying, but I was just like cooking. Like I would be that, everybody in university has that one person that can actually cook in the dorm, in their house, and that was me.
What was your dish that you made in the dorm?
I didn't have like a signature dish, but it would just be making good home cooked meals, like pasta from scratch, like turkey.
From scratch?
Yeah. you know, a full Thanksgiving dinner. Like right. I'd be the one hosting the meals.
Right, right. Meanwhile, for me, it was like literally cake out of a box. I think that was where I was at that stage of my life. You know, in so many ways, what you do today is kind of sort of chemical engineering in a way where you can see kind of like parallels in what you do today and your previous career. How did that discipline influence the way that you approach your line of work today and what you and how you think about food in general?
I think first and foremost, I definitely don't regret doing engineering first, because it's what separates me from other chefs. I think having a good foundation and education is paramount. So it's crazy. A lot of people in this industry just can't do like basic math. Like when I'm saying to scale a recipe, like I just need two times of this. It's just like even doing basic math of that is so vital to our industry. And then the fact that I went through like engineering, business management is crucial to running operations in terms of efficiency, cost, labor. Like a lot of those things are not genuinely taught in culinary school. So I think I was better off going to engineering and then pursuing my passion versus just going to culinary school to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. And how much, I mean, as a restaurant owner now, how much, and you obviously have your other restaurant too, how much of your, you know, role would you say is dedicated to creating food and then also dedicated to managing the business? Because that's obviously, these are two very important parts of your business and your role. Where do you find that kind of tug and pull? Where is that ratio for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say for R&D, it was more so focused on cooking at first and then building the restaurant, because it was my first restaurant. And I had Oliver and Bonchini as a backing. So like they did all the back end stuff, the setting up stuff, the HR, the payroll.
Sure.
I could just focus on menu and grow as a chef. And then with this restaurant, you know, it's just Alvin and me. So Alvin's never here, so obviously it's just me.
Yeah.
So like setting up the liquor license, the website, the business cards, the uniforms, the permits, like everything I had to take on. So for this project, I surrounded myself with like a very talented team of chefs that can execute my vision, but I don't really have to be as present in the kitchen until we open. So yeah, I've been very fortunate with my team. But for this one in particular, I've been way more business operations oriented than in the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a 2.0 for you, the next level there. so we're sitting here in your restaurant and you know, you've prepared some lovely dishes here. But before we kind of talk about these, like what does the concept of breaking bread mean to you and like kind of being able to gather around a table? What do you think that says about like a community and a culture around the customs and traditions around gathering together to share a meal?
I think everybody's got to eat, for one, but two, especially being growing up in a Chinese culture, like food is what brings family together. Like people would literally travel from around the world to celebrate Chinese New Year, to celebrate birthdays. Like my relatives from like Singapore, Malaysia, China would literally come just for these huge meals, these huge banquets. It's not even like weddings we're talking about, it's just birthdays. And I think having that, like breaking bread and having like sharing a meal with family and friends is something that I just grew up being accustomed to. So like, I'm not gonna say like which cultures, but like my non-Asian friends would never make it a priority to like rush home and have dinner with their family. However, me growing up, it's always like, no, dinner with my family, it's like a given. Like that's family time, that's when you converse, that's when you catch up, that's when you enjoy, that's when you're the most happy with your family, is when you guys are just eating really good food. And food was always a priority for me. Even when we're going booking vacations, booking resorts, it's not about like the accommodations or whatever, it's like where has the best food. And I think that translates in my passion for cooking.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. And so you've created some beautiful dishes here as a preview on your menu right now. Can you talk to me about what you've prepared here?
Right. So I think inspiration as a whole for Akin is the trends of like foodies or people dining these days really want to have a sense of relatability. So akin obviously means comparable to or relatable to. Mm-hmm. And I think when every guest, whether they're Asian or not, can connect to the dish, it's way more memorable for them. I could easily bring a whole platter of ingredients that you've never heard of, and everyone would be like, that was great, but like, I can't even describe it. So I specifically chose dishes that people have at least heard of, even if they're not part of Asian culture, mm-hmm. And then just done my own modern spin on it. So for the first one, the center is inspired by congee. I know it doesn't look like congee, but almost everybody has heard of congee or rice porridge. And then usually in Asian culture, we serve it with a yaotu, which is like a Chinese donut.
Okay.
It's like the long, like,
cylindrical. Oh, yes. Yeah.
It usually comes in twos.
Yeah. It's like a fried, like,
a fried donut. Yeah. So we took that inspiration. We made a crystal version of that, completely clear. We made a congee puree. Usually it's served with a lam choy, which is a fermented olive leaf. We made that into an aioli. And obviously a congee always has like a pork stock or some sort of soup. So we made a delicious pork stock, cooked it down with potatoes, dehydrated it, and then turned it into a pork powder on top.
Wow.
So when you eat that, it's like reminiscent flavors, relatable flavors to congee, except it's just reimagined into our own modern way.
Right, right. And the textures too, you know, that's so much a part of the sensory experience as well, not just necessarily the flavors that you're having too.
Yeah. That's and then amazing. This dish is inspired by hot pot. So hot pot, I find, you know, I did a lot of like research prior to choosing which dish, but hot pot is one of those places that I see a lot of non-Asians. Obviously Asians are there, but like when you go to specific restaurants, it's always like, I try and choose where else the non-Asians dine, because then these are the dishes that they can actually at least appreciate and recognize.
And almost like a gateway, like easy, like from an accessibility standpoint, something that's familiar-ish.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So my favorite hot pot broth is like the Sichuan, the mala, the spicy one. So we did a really intense mala broth, and everybody does spherification, or a lot of people do, but I haven't come across one that actually suspends meat in it. So we've suspended some ground Iberico pork in the soup dumpling, and then underneath konjac noodles, it's like these little bundles of noodles that I love like dipping in and soaking the broth.
Mm-hmm.
We've compressed it with a black vinegar reduction and cilantro oil, because whenever you have hot pot, there's always like all the garnishes, a bunch of cilantro, so I wanted to keep those elements in it. And then visually, I like close my eyes. I always picture like an abundance of ingredients, different colors, and like a layer of oil that sits at the top of your hot pot.
Yeah.
So I wanted to garnish it with a thin layer of lardo and a bunch of micro garnishes to represent an abundant selection of hot pot.
That's so beautiful. Mm. Oh my gosh. And it's meant to be, because talk about also the thought process in terms of how you intend your diners to consume. Like, is it supposed to be just a one bite thing, or how are they meant to navigate their way through a dish?
Mm-hmm. Great question, because there are some dishes that is supposed to be one bite because it's more flavor oriented. So like it's an explosion of flavor, it's surprising, it's a sensation. And then there's others that are like multiple bites because it's more satisfying and it's a craveability aspect where you want to just dive in for more. So like our lobster dish, for example, uses laksa, and that sauce is like so craveable. You obviously want to have a bit more carbs, a bit more noodles, a bit more protein that you can just keep going back for more and more. But something as intense as hot pot is meant for one bite, because it's incredible on your first bite, but going back, the level will never be the same.
Right.
So it does take a certain type of balance, but I wouldn't say it's the same for every dish. It really depends on the flavor profile.
Right, right, right. And what's this last one here?
So the last one is inspired by two types of tofu. So in Asian cuisine, there's like a chrysanthemum tofu and an almond tofu. Almond tofu is usually like sweet version, and then chrysanthemum tofu showcases knife skill and usually done with like a savory broth. So this is our pre-dessert. At the bottom, there's a pear jam. The tofu is an almond panna cotta, and then we hand slice it to make it open up like a chrysanthemum, and then we pair it with a osmanthus syrup.
Wow, that's stunning. Okay, so should we try? Like, are you gonna eat with me?
No, I never eat my own food.
No, you don't eat your own food.
I just taste and then that's it.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
But yeah, I'm one of those weirdos that just watch people eat. So if we're going in chronological order of the tasting menu, I'd recommend starting with our snacks, like one bite of the yaotiu.
Okay.
And then one mouthful of the hot pot.
Nice. Okay. Wow, that is so delicate too. So how do you I mean, this is, I feel like, also just so beautiful because it also, I feel like, kind of speaks to your background just in, like, engineering a dish and a snack. And it's so beautiful the way that, like, it's, like, it looks like a little building, too. Like, yeah. The way that it's constructed, too. It's a piece of art. Beautiful. And what are the flowers here?
Alyssum flowers. So it's also, like, local Alyssum flowers.
Wow. That's really nice. You know what this almost reminds me of in Korean, at the Korean grocery store, we have these rice cakes that have like this powder on. I don't actually know what the powder is made out of, but the the consistency and the flavor profile is like very, very, it reminds me of that too. And it reminds me of like a sense of home, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's a familiarity to it. Have you ever had those little like rice cakes with the dusting
on it? I've had tteokbokki, but not like a dried version.
Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Jeremy.
Yeah.
The brown, like the
with the powder? Yeah. It's really, really nice though.
It's rice flour.
Okay.
It's okay, you don't eat it all. It's been sitting a while.
And then the next one, do you recommend this one?
Yeah, one mouthful.
One mouth, okay. I'm gonna be very graceful here. And so, and you have on top here, that's the lardo. And then
a little micro shrimp and a bunch of micro garnishes that we cut.
Wow.
Colorful.
So how long does that take to prepare for you?
This is one of our most labor intensive dishes for
right.
sure. Yeah. Cause the lardo is like so temperature sensitive. Like people literally have to ring cut it in the freezer.
Wow. So actually that's something that I'm curious about too, is like what goes into the thought process of like just the amount of resources and time that it takes to create one dish when you're planning a 10 course meal. Obviously, you know, some dishes will take more time to prepare and to create. What's the thought process behind that and trying to create a balance in terms of your capacity in creating your dishes?
Yeah, I think you definitely have to balance people's time, because like for me, I just think of it as man hours, right? So in an allotted day, let's say I have 8 staff, 10 hours, I have 80 man hours. Mm-hmm. Right, so then you just start ticking away tasks, go through the whole menu, and like, okay, I literally have 1 man hour after the whole menu, and there's no wiggle room, so I need to adjust something. So either a component needs to change, or people just have to get better. But like, it's usually not people getting better. Because, like, you can't just make magic out of the you know, thin air. So
right. Okay. Well. Oh, that's amazing. Oh, it's got like a little kick to it too.
Yeah.
I like it. Very nice. Which one's your favorite dish that you have on your menu right now?
I would say our lobster dish, just because lobster is my favorite ingredient.
Okay.
We even designed it with like a DNA pattern on the rim, just because it is such a close ingredient to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I literally wear like a lobster claw around my neck.
What do you think it is about the lobster that speaks to you so much?
One, it's one of the fondest memories I have cooking with my grandfather, and something that he always specialized, something that I always craved growing up. Every time we go over to his house, it's like whole lobster. And even now, he knows it's my favorite thing. So like every time I go home, he's like, oh, Eric's coming home, I'll go get some lobsters.
Right.
I like butcher it, like all the guts splash all over the kitchen, and then stir fries it with like ginger scallion, done it like classically Chinese, but it's like, it's just something that is nostalgic, yes, but I think it's objectively delicious as well. Because like every time somebody else comes over, they're just like, wow, this is incredible.
It's also like kind of like a showstopper too. Like it just has a lot of impact visually too. Mm. Very nice. Okay, last one here. So how do I eat this? Is it like,
You can just like cut bits of it and then have it with a Samantha syrup.
Okay.
But it's like super delicate. This is a good like segue into the sweet portion of our tasting menu.
Mm. Oh yeah, that's really nice. Very delicate. And what goes into your thought process too? Because obviously it's not just about the food itself, but it's also how it's being presented. Like, what kind of consideration do you have when it comes to the utensils, the plating, the vessels? How much thought do you go into? Are you doom scrolling at night looking at a bunch of bowls and plates, or what does that look like?
No, we have like, we put a lot of thought in the plateware, because I think a lot of the higher end restaurants, especially in the city here, they all use like the same expensive French plates.
Right.
We wanted something to be very unique, something that with the utmost confidence, nobody else in the city has these plates because they're handmade. They're all custom for us. So like as you progress through our tasting menu, you'll begin to see how much work has gone into not just the food, but the plates as well. So like we have a chawanmushi dish that features uni, and then the bowl is a handmade uni plate with like spikes on it. Mm-hmm. The fish course is like a laser cut fish skeleton. There's our bread gets served on the laser cut like candle holder. Because my biggest pet peeve is having cold bread.
Right.
So like I thought it'd be great to serve it with a candle and have guaranteeing your bread's gonna stay warm.
Right.
A lot of thought has gone into our plates as well.
Because they in and of themselves are art in the same way that your food and also like your space is like it's a part of the whole experience, right? Growing up for me, you know, we're talking about like our formative years and like the things that we saw growing up in the kitchen. The kitchen was such an important part, an important room in the household for me. It was like really a space of like warmth and love, and it's really kind of the when I think about my childhood, the kitchen is really like the main place I think about, and also the dishes that a lot of my memories are associated with. For me, it was, you know, having a bunch of like punch on dishes, or like the kind of like comfort of like kimchi jjigae, or like even like the simplicity of just like a really beautiful rice dish, you know. What is the most impactful dish for you from your childhood that has shaped your perspective on your work today? You talked about lobster and the lobster dishes that your grandfather makes for you, but what is the dish that has really kind of influenced your perspective on your food today?
Wow, one that perhaps I've consumed or one that I've been taught how to make?
I would say more so like what has influenced your, like as a result of you consuming it and has brought you joy or has brought you perspective and is something that you want to share with your diners, like what has been a dish, or not even a specific dish, maybe like a cuisine or something that just has influenced your perspective on your work.
I would say, I know it sounds a bit cheesy, but what really drove me to this point was the first time I tried Bonovation. Literally after I won MasterChef, Alvin flew me out to Hong Kong, and at the time, this was like 10 years ago, there was no Michelin stars in Canada. I didn't really travel like into Europe or internationally to try these like fine dining restaurants. So that was like the moment where I realized the extent in which cooking could really be pushed, because I was pushing boundaries. I was using molecular gastronomy. That was a whole other level that I've never been exposed to. So it just showed how close-minded I was in terms of food. Like I was just watching Food Network, doing a bunch of home cooking stuff, and I was like, man, this is great. Like making my own pasta and doing some pastries, like a little souffle, was like super impressive at the time.
Right.
And then you get into like foams, spherification, like stuff that doesn't even look like food. That was like super eye-opening. And at that moment I was like, wow, there's like so much more work that I need to get done before I can even come close to that level.
Yeah. And like kind of building on that, where do you find the aspect of, you know, tradition and kind of honoring culinary tradition and flavors and tastes and influences with innovation and like pushing boundaries? Where do you yourself find that intersection and at play?
I think tradition is a tricky word, because tradition is very similar to authenticity when you're talking about food, because everybody has their own tradition, everybody has their own perspective on what authentic is. And I think that was a big crux to when I opened R&D. That's why we wanted to make food here that's relatable. Because when we opened R&D, everybody at the time was like, oh, there's no like authentic restaurant. There's nobody doing like authentic flavors. So we tried to do like authentic flavors fusion in our own way. And one key example where it was eye-opening for me was we made our own oyster sauce from scratch that tasted like authentic from scratch oyster sauce that you would get in Hong Kong. And it was like identical. We brought that here. We paired it with an oyster dish, or it was a sweetbread dish, or beef tongue dish. It was a beef tongue dish.
Okay.
But when people taste it, they're like, man, this is so fishy. Like, this tastes so weird because people are used to the Lee Kum Kee oyster sauce.
Yep.
So that's one key example where it's irrelevant what is authentic or a tradition. It's relevant what the perspective of the guests are thinking.
Sure.
Because, like, they come in with their idea of what they think authentic and tradition is. So it doesn't matter what I think. If the majority of people in Toronto think that Lee Kum Kee oyster sauce is authentic or traditional, then of course I have to cater to those palates. So it's very delicate balance when you're talking about tradition and authentic, because my tradition is way different than 90% of the guests that dine here.
Do you find that your role personally is to kind of challenge any kind of preconceived notions around what people may perceive as authentic or traditional, and kind of open up their palates to, you know, broader flavor profiles? Or do you find that it's more about accommodating those, the familiar, and just having a different perspective on it?
I think there are people that do both approaches, mm-hmm. but I think for me it's way easier and more effective to connect with guests who can have some sense of relatability and not push them over the edge. Mm. Because of course I'm introducing new flavors, but I'm not introducing, like, I view it as a scale of like 1 to 10, right? If 10 is like so foreign, they don't know what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
And like 1 is like, oh, I've had this a million times.
Yeah.
I push it to like probably like a 7.
Okay.
7 where it's like still exciting, still engaging, still new for them, but not like to the point where they can't even remember what they just had, because
they have no reference.
That was a huge red flag for me as a chef. When I went and ate at a restaurant, I'm not gonna name the name, but it was a 1-star restaurant that did Latin American cuisine, and it was incredible. The food was presented well, tasted great. I took photos, and when I was showing Alvin, like, the food, he always asked me, like, oh, let me see the photos. He's like, what is that? I'm like, huh, you're right, what is that? And he's like, what do you mean? You just had it. It was literally the next day.
Right.
And I was like, I couldn't even explain to him what it was.
Right.
And that to me was like something that I never forget. Me as a chef can't remember. Yeah. How is any normal, like, guest who's not even in the food industry supposed to remember? So, like, it's not effective for me to just serve all this, like, super, there's like, I found the only farmer in China who finds this ingredient. It's pronounced like something that you can't even say.
Yeah.
And then they're like, wow, this is really cool. But then when they're talking about it to friends, when they're talking about it to other people, like, man, Akin was great. They're like, well, what was the food like? They're like, oh, it was like, what did I have?
Yeah.
You know, so like I thought it was so important to have this connection with every guest, and not just really push it to the level 10 where they can't really remember what they had.
Right. You started off, you know, with humble beginnings as an amateur chef before taking home the title on MasterChef. When do you think you discovered your point of view as a chef and your unique perspective, or really like what you wanted to say to the world about your own work? Where do you think you found your voice?
I don't even know if I found my voice yet, to be honest. I think, you know, it's a dream of every chef to become a Michelin star chef, or every aspiring, like, passionate chef. And that's the one thing that is, like, globally recognized. So until I get that accolade, I don't know if I have my voice. It's always that imposter syndrome. You know, there is a chef, I'm not going to name his name, but there have been multiple chefs where when people apply here, and then they let their boss know, like, where they're going, multiple of them say, oh, you're going to go work for that home cook. So it's,
wow, okay. You know,
that is something that drives me. That is something that, yeah, it's kind of true, I suppose, but I've been a professional chef for 10 years now.
Yeah.
But at what point will I stop being a home cook in other people's eyes? And maybe it's when I get a star, maybe it's when I get 2 stars, who knows? Mm. But it's something that is always in the back of my head, that, like, everybody else in the industry, or like majority of people, still view me as a home cook.
Interesting. I mean, you are a home cook that has built up an incredible profile for yourself, and you're a professional, or you started off as a home cook, but, you know, obviously you've transcended so many boundaries and milestones since then. You were also, you know, taken under the wing of Alvin, who was a judge on your season, is your mentor and now your business partner. How has working with him challenged or reshaped your approach to cooking? You kind of alluded to that a little bit before, but what kind of new perspectives were brought into the conversation for you?
I think he has a, we have similar upbringings, but he also has a different view in, or a different approach to cooking in general. One is his motto is always taste is king. So like, if you notice his food at Bo doesn't have a lot of touches, we call it, like a lot of garnishes, a lot of components. It's always based on taste. And that's the most memorable thing. Like if the food tastes good, you're always going to remember it. And second is like, doesn't matter how big you are. Like he's a 3 Michelin star chef. He still goes out and dines. And that's a huge thing that I try and implore our chefs to do, or I even take them out to meals. Cause I think it's so important to really try what's out there. A lot of people are just so boxed in on work, and like all I'm gonna do is focus on my own cooking, but like I've grown so much by literally just trying the best restaurants in the world. Just I know people don't always have the funds to do so, but it's vital to literally just try other people's food,
giving a diversity of perspective. Do you find that Toronto is a city that offers that richness in kind of its culinary offerings, and not just food but also like hospitality? Do you think that that is the city is a good ecosystem for that?
The city has a lot of potential to be a great ecosystem for that. I think currently, obviously Michelin coming to Toronto has helped immensely. You've had way more, like a whole another level up of cooking. But there's a reason Canada doesn't have a single three Michelin star restaurant.
Yeah.
It's not just a coincidence. It's not like rigged. It's when you go travel around the world, when you go to Europe, when you go to Asia, when you go to these places that have like 3 stars, it is like a whole another level, not only in terms of the food, not only in terms of the techniques, but the level of service. I don't know if Canada can ever get there because it's so expensive here. Everything is just so expensive. When you go into these places of like Europe and other places, they're like staffed like crazy,
right?
Like 2-to-1. It's insane how much staff they have, but like that is not economically sustainable in Toronto. Like rent is so high. Like a lot of my employees can't live in Toronto because rent is so high. So like they're from Scarborough, they're from Markham, they have to commute. There's like a lot of factors that will hinder us from getting to that level. But like in all these other countries, labor's cheaper, rent is cheaper, ingredients are cheaper. They can really pour themselves into having a massive team. And obviously if I had like double the amount of staff, yeah, I'm not saying it wouldn't be easier. Service would obviously be better.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's just another level, especially ones that are in like hotels. It's like, dude, we don't have the real estate to make these grand restaurants, to make these restaurants that have like trolleys and dessert carts, bread carts. It's like a crazy experience when you go to these places, and it's like a, like Alchemist I went to in Copenhagen. It's literally the size of the Sky Dome, like a full stadium. And you walk in like 4 different rooms while you're eating. There's a ball pit in that restaurant. After one of the courses, you get to go play in a ball pit. It was like, you'll never see something like that in Canada.
Right.
But yeah, like Toronto, I wouldn't say it's an unfair question because our circumstances are different.
Yes.
Yeah.
What do you think is a risk that you've taken, or maybe even a risk that your business partner Alvin has encouraged you to take that has paid off in a way that you didn't expect?
I feel like being in the hospitality industry is a risk in itself, man. Like, to be honest, that's enough of a risk. Like even opening up fine dining is a risk in itself. He always told me like I'm doing this for you. Like I would never open another Bo because Bo is so different, so difficult to replicate. But I'm like, to him, I was like, well, Bo is what made you who you are. Like I think you need, in my perspective, you need a fine dining restaurant because it's the only way you can showcase your passion, your creativity, and your true potential and skill as a chef. So yeah, fine dining has like a lot of risk in terms of the overhead. Like everything here, there's just like, compared to R&D, there's just so many more expenses. Like the hand towels in the washroom, like the quality of toilet paper, the candles, like everything is just adding in expenses. So like there's a lot of things besides the food that a lot of people may not recognize in terms of why things are so expensive. Like even your take-home bag. Like, that costs money. The branded take-home bag, the branded menus, the things that people get to take home is not, and all the disposables is not something that is, that comes for free.
Yeah, yeah. Excuse me, of course. And so, you know, building on that, you know, you were talking about your experience building R&D, and, you know, you were able to focus on really the creation and the menu and the food. And then here's, you know, a slightly different experience in that you were taking on a lot more of, like, the business operation and being able to build the brand, the business, everything outside that orbits around the actual food itself. How do you find your experience has been in terms of navigating business decisions without compromising also just your artistic vision too? Do you find those things are at odds with each other a lot of times, or do you find that they kind of go in tandem and complement each other?
No, they're definitely at odds. They're like, most certainly always at odds.
Yeah.
But like, I don't want to make excuses for myself as well. Cause like anybody would say like, oh, if I didn't have to do this, this or this, I'd be so much better at doing this. But it's like, that's not the job as a business owner. I can't make excuses like, oh, if I didn't have to worry about the contractors, if I didn't have to worry about like setting up a liquor license, the food would be 10 times better. I don't think that's the case. It's how you can handle these high pressure scenarios and just balance things internally, balance my time, balance my focus. Because opening a restaurant is not easy, but nobody ever said it was.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so you're bringing in, you know, a very talented team of, you know, people that are able to execute your artistic vision for the business. What's like the advice that you would give to them in terms of their own ambitions and aspirations of kind of building and living in this world too?
Mm-hmm. I think one thing for sure, I think one thing that I've learned from opening a kin is that everybody has the hunger for high-end cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
At least everybody in the F&B. So like, we've been very fortunate in terms of the staff that we've got to choose. You know, R&D, I wouldn't say, put it this way, it's definitely harder to hire for R&D than it is for here. But I also create a workspace where I'm very open. So like, the first thing I ask when I interview somebody is like, what do you want to see in your next workplace? And I try and cater to those needs, because everybody obviously has their own ambitions. Everybody has their own wants, and everybody needs to grow with the business. It's super important. I can't just expect these employees just to work without any gain. Mm-hmm. Right? Everybody's doing it for a purpose, whether it's monetary, whether it's for knowledge, whether it's to literally have this close connection with a business owner. Because there's a lot of other restaurants that have this hierarchy where you don't even have that relationship with the business owner. But this is like as close as you're ever gonna get. I'm literally
alongside them.
Yeah. Like a working owner. And that's very valuable. Like, people wanna learn how to operate their own restaurant, because everybody in this industry, it is a passion-driven industry. So people are passionate about doing this. People have dreams and aspirations to open their own one day. And you don't always get that direct connection with somebody who knows how to open a restaurant.
What's one skill that you think every restaurateur needs to have before building their business?
Patience. an unreal amount of patience and empathy. And really trying to understand the position that the employee is in, how they view it from their perspective. So, yeah, because everybody has their own situation, but like, our industry is so volatile because of the lifestyle, because it takes a specific type of human to want to work these long hours. Like, everybody here is like so committed. They've been here just as long as I have, like, hour-wise. Like, they get in, there's two chefs here that was here before me.
Right.
Because they're just passionate about the work. Patience, though. Like, man, it just doesn't... Yeah, I don't know. I just can't stress the amount of patience I've had throughout this whole process.
Have you always been a patient person?
No, not at all. not even at all. Like, 10 years ago, me would just... you know, be very temperamental, lose my cool actually, quite a bit. And now it's really just thinking about how I can make the best out of my situation.
Yeah.
And trying to balance the pros and cons, whether I just accept, you know, the situation or just like lose control and scream, because half the times I just want to lose control.
Yeah. I understand. So, you know, we're sitting here in, again, it's a beautiful, beautiful restaurant that you've recently opened. Congratulations as well.
Thank you.
What's the defining philosophy behind the restaurant itself and the menu? What guides every decision that you make here?
I think the two things, one, relatability, which I already touched on, mm-hmm. but two is offering a unique dining experience. Like, where I think we're trying to fill a void that the void in Toronto's dining scene. Like right now, ever since Michelin came, there's a lot more like fine dining restaurants, a lot more tasting menus, mm-hmm. but there's not a single truly Asian inspired one. You have mm-hmm. your omakases, you have your like sushi ones, but there's not one that does flavors inspired by like Southeast Asia, Pan Asian cuisine. Like we have Singaporean, Malaysian, Japanese, Thai, mm-hmm. Even Vietnamese influence, Korean influences, like mm-hmm. throughout our dishes. So like we are combining a bunch of Asian flavors. It's not just like Japanese or French Japanese or Chinese. It is an amalgamation of all of Asia, of all of our travels, of all of these dishes that I think are very popular to non-Asians.
Is there a narrative or a story that you're looking to tell through as people progress through the menu and through their dining experience?
I wouldn't say there's a natural progression to it, but it's just end of the day, I'm just trying to make food that tastes delicious, that is unique, and it comes down to the design being unique, the plates being unique, the whole experience being something that they can't get in another restaurant in Toronto.
Mm. What's a misconception that you think people have about fine dining that you'd love to kind of dispel or unpack?
I think a misconception is that they're going to leave hungry. Like here,
right,
during our softs, and I'm sure you'll find yourself, is that you're definitely going to be satisfied and full when you leave. And that was one thing that I wanted to make sure, because like, you know, Asian culture, you never want people to leave hungry.
Right.
And I can confidently say, like, yeah, we definitely have enough food, like almost too much.
Yeah, exactly. I know that is definitely a thing where leaving a restaurant and still feeling like you need to go for another meal is an interesting experience for sure.
And I think it just comes down to comfort, mm-hmm. right? Because fine dining is about making guests feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And comfort comes in so many different ways, but like a lot of people think it's like a stuffy environment that there's somebody hovering over your shoulders, but this is a very casual, engaging service where like even the chefs come out to run the food, to serve the food. It's like a whole team environment where it feels like the whole team is working to serve you and to make you comfortable. Yeah. It's not just like only the servers get to run the food. It's more just like an engaging, comfortable dining experience.
Yeah. You know, you've achieved so much in your career, from, you know, winning MasterChef to kind of traveling all around the world under and learning through under Alvin's wing, and then opening up R&D and now Akin. Have your goals always been the same throughout that course, or have they evolved as you've surpassed them? What does that look like for you?
I think everybody, they definitely evolve, because like every time there's always gonna be a new goal. Mm-hmm. It's just the ambition. So like, you know, entering MasterChef, my goal is to win MasterChef, conquer that. After MasterChef, it's like, well, I really want to open a restaurant, and you open a restaurant. And then your next goal is like, well, I want a profitable restaurant, and you make it profitable.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's like, you know what, I really want a fine dining restaurant, actually, because like after mm-hmm. trying all these tasting menus, that's what I'm most passionate about.
Yeah.
And then now we're here. And then the next goal is one Michelin star. And I'm sure if, once I get that, it'll be 2, 3. Like the goals never stop.
Yeah.
So I think the goals are constantly evolving, but there's one common theme, is that it's always one goal first. You can't chase multiple goals at a time. So once I conquer my next goal, which is to earn at least one Michelin star, then we'll see what the next goal is.
How do you stay hungry, metaphorically speaking, about your line of work? Because it's obviously a passion-driven industry and line of work. It is something that, is not for the faint of heart. So how do you still stay hungry and stay passionate about everything that you're doing?
I'd say it's two things that drive me. One is me being an extremely petty, spiteful person. And I just like to prove people wrong. So like everybody that is like, oh yeah, chefs can't do anything. Chefs don't make money. You're just a home cook. All those comments like drive me to try and be the best. And second, it's the amount of sacrifices it takes to be great in this industry. Sacrifices from not spending time with your family. So sacrifices from not spending time with your friends. Financial sacrifices, everything. It has to be sacrifices you're willing to make for a purpose. So my purpose is to have an incredible restaurant that I can be proud of. It'd be a shame to miss the first year of my son's life for nothing.
Yeah.
Right. So that is, it's almost like doubling down in gambling. Like if I just stop now, well, what is the whole purpose of missing my son's childhood?
Right.
I have to make it great. So I have to double down, put in even more time, miss more time with my friends and family to genuinely make this place incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Last question. What excites you the most about the road ahead, the next year, the next 5 years, the next 10 years? Like what's that kind of North Star for you?
I don't know. What excites me the most is that I'm so close to realizing a lifelong dream of being a Michelin star chef. That is it's not something that everybody says like, oh yeah, chase your dreams. And like for the longest time, Michelin wasn't in Canada. So it's like, I'm never going to move out of Canada to open up a restaurant just to chase that dream. Cause it's like my friends and family are here. I'm not going to like relocate.
Yeah.
But then when that came to Canada, it's like, wow, this dream's actually attainable. And I don't know how many people can truly relate to that, where it's like a dream that you've had for well over a decade can actually be achieved within this next year. Like September next year, I could realize my lifelong dream, which is very exciting for me and something that doesn't come along to everybody. So I'm very grateful for all the investors, for all the help, for my team, for everybody who's just committed to this. And it is like something selfish, but it's something that I want. It's not just my family wants or like whatever. This is something that I want, that I've been wanting to chase for a long time. So being this close to realizing a lifelong dream is pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's within arm's reach now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm so happy for you and excited for you to, not just for the opening, but also for, you know, the year ahead and just the incredible experiences that people are going to have as they come through your doors and learn more about, you know, your work and your story and just, you know, how it's adding to our culture here as a world-class city that can create really, truly amazing food experiences. So I'm really excited for you.
Thank you so much. Can't wait for you to have the full meal.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Eric. I really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, who you'd like to see on the show, and anything else you want to share. To keep up to date, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to your podcast. Until next time, ask yourself, what's your mission?